I'm calling to order this special meeting of the Washington Metropolitan Area Transit Authority Board of Directors. And Ms. Akara, if you would show the National Transportation Safety Board people how to turn on their microphones, just to make sure that they will all be recorded in this. On behalf of the Washington Metro Board of Directors, I welcome NTSB Chairman Herzman and all the members of the NTSB Board. We have reviewed the report which you have prepared, or the information which you have provided on the June 22, 2009 accident, and we really appreciate your offer to come and talk with us today and to clarify your recommendations as they relate to the role of this board, the Metro Board, in assuring Metro safety. Safety is the top priority at Metro for our board, for our managers, and for our staff from top to bottom. So we welcome you and we welcome your comments. On behalf of the board, let me clarify that this board intends to assure that, to the best of our ability, each and every NTSB recommendation associated with your review of the June 22, 2009 accident is implemented. The board and our staff have already started to do that, to implement those recommendations. And we will comment on some of those actions. And later on, I will be calling on the general manager to report on the status and our future directions relative to carrying out the recommendations that you have given. So we welcome this opportunity to improve our understanding of the critical issues which can improve the actions of this board, the Metro Board, in enhancing the safety of our passengers, of our employees, and of the general public. Ms. Herzman?
Thank you very much, Chairman Benjamin and members of the WMATA board. It's good to be here with you today. Thank you for scheduling this meeting. It's a unique circumstance that brings the members of our board together with the members of the WMATA board. And while our investigations look back at the circumstances that led to the accident, it's my hope that today will be provided an opportunity for all of us to look forward to what can be done to improve safety. Joining with me today are Vice Chairman Chris Hart, Member Robert Sumwalt, Member Mark Rosekind, and Member Earl Wehner. I'll begin with a brief discussion of the Safety Board's findings from the investigation of the June 22, 2009 collision involving two Red Line trains. This presentation includes an animation that we showed at our board meeting about 2 weeks ago. As you know, the accident resulted in 9 fatalities, including the train operator. The emergency response agencies reported transporting 52 people to local hospitals. What our investigators found, and the report concluded, was that the collision resulted from a failure of the track circuit modules, which caused the automatic train control system to lose detection of one train, allowing a second train to strike it from the rear. The NTSB also cited WMATA for failing to ensure that the verification test developed after a 2005 incident involving 2 near collisions near Roslyn was used system-wide. This test would have identified the faulty track circuit before the accident. Beyond the track circuits, the Safety Board's investigation also revealed layers of safety deficiencies and a systemic breakdown of safety management at all levels. The Safety Board concluded that the following factors also contributed to the accident: the lack of a safety culture within WMATA, ineffective oversight by the WMATA Board of Directors and the Tri-State Oversight Committee, the Federal Transit Administration's lack of statutory authority to provide federal safety oversight. We also cited WMATA's failure to retrofit or replace the 1000 series cars as contributing to the severity of injuries and the number of fatalities. As a result of this investigation, the Safety Board made over 20 recommendations to the U.S. Department of Transportation, to the Federal Transit Administration, to the TOC, to WMATA, to Alstom Signaling, to transit authorities in six states that use the GRS Generation 2 modules, and also one recommendation to the WMATA Board of Directors. I'd like to now show an animation of the accident sequence. The motion of the struck train, number 214, was derived from data retrieved from its event recorders. The striking train, number 112, did not have event recorders. Consequently, its motion was derived from a simulation based on speed commands from the train control system and train performance characteristics. The animation shows two views of the train in real time. The top of the screen shows an overhead view of both trains as they traveled inbound on the red line from Tacoma to the Fort Totten station. Striking train 112 is indicated by a blue arrow, and the struck train 214 is identified by an orange arrow. The yellow dots on the track delineate each segment of track circuits. The WMATA's automatic train control system is designed to issue speed commands to ensure that at least one unoccupied track circuit separates trains. The middle section of the screen shows the time of day, the speed commands issued by the train control system, and the actual speeds of each train. Finally, the bottom of the screen shows a view riding along with the striking train up to the point that it collided with the stopped train. Please begin the animation.
The animation begins with train 112's departure from Tacoma Station, about 2.5 minutes before the collision. Train 112 is being operated in the automatic mode, where the train responds automatically to the speed commands from the train control system. At this time, train 214 is approaching Fort Totten and is about 0.8 miles ahead of train 112. Train 214 is being operated in the manual mode, where the operator controls the motion of the train according to the speed commands from the train control system. Notice that the speed command for train 112 varies with the position of the train ahead. Its actual speed lags behind the speed command. At this point, the system has brought the speed command for train 112 to zero due to the presence of train 214 ahead, and train 112 automatically begins to slow to a stop. The lead train, 214, is on a faulty track circuit. The speed command displays zero, and the operator of 214 begins to manually slow the train to a stop. Because the train control system cannot detect train 214, it responds as if the track ahead is clear and transmits an errant speed command of 55 miles per hour. Train 112 automatically begins accelerating to 55 miles per hour, with train 214 stopped and undetected just ahead. According to sight distance testing, at 470 feet apart, the operator of train 112 had a full view of train 214. Approximately 3 seconds after the train 112 operator has a full view of the stopped train, she applies emergency braking. Braking action was normal, but there was only enough time to slow the train a few miles per hour.
The probable cause of the accident was again the failure of the track circuit modules that caused the automatic train control system to lose detection of train 214 and thus transmit speed commands to train 112 up to the point of impact. and WMATA's failure to ensure that an enhanced track circuit verification test was institutionalized and used system-wide, which would have identified the faulty track circuit before the accident. We also identified a number of contributing factors to the crash, including WMATA's lack of a safety culture and the lack of effective oversight by the Board of Directors, the TOC, and the Federal Transit Administration. We made 23 recommendations out of this report, of which 15 were specifically directed to WMATA, and one recommendation was directed to you as the Board of Directors. Our recommendation to the WMATA Board asks you to elevate your safety oversight of the organization in three ways. Develop a policy statement to explicitly and publicly assume the responsibilities for continual oversight of system safety. Two, implementing processes to exercise effective oversight of the system, including taking proactive measures, such as looking at safety performance metrics. And finally, to evaluate the actions that are taken in response to the Safety Board, Federal Transit Administration recommendations, as well as the status of open corrective action plans and the results of audits conducted by the Tri-State Oversight Committee. As you know, we have three ongoing investigations from Metro's incidents and accidents in the last year, including the Falls Church November 2009 event, the Rockville two fatal January 2010 event, and the February 2010 Farragut North derailment. Thank you very much, Chairman Benjamin, for your welcome, and we look forward to having a constructive dialogue with you today.
Thank you, Chairman Herzman. And as I see that that video, I am again struck with the fact that at that moment on June 22nd of last year, those of us here in Metro lost our innocence. It was a time when we could no longer claim that we were the safest system in the country, if not the world. It was a time when we could no longer rely upon our history. It was a time when we had to go back and start over again and say, we have got to make this system as safe as it is possible to make it. And that's why we would like to talk with you today, and that's what we want to talk with you today about, because we don't want anything like that ever to happen or even come close to having happen. That having been said, the primary statement that you have made is that board oversight, this board's oversight of safety, was ineffective. And clearly, if accidents like this happen, there is something more that we need to be able to do. We as a board have often been criticized for being micromanagers and for getting too far into the detail of how our system operates and what people are doing for safety and all of the other issues that are involved with this transit system. It would appear to me that your recommendation seems to go in the opposite direction, but it isn't absolutely clear that what it is that you think we should be doing differently, other than we always did get, and you acknowledged, safety performance metrics given to us, and the thing that we did not get, and did not get sufficiently, was the status of open action items of investigations in what we were doing as an agency to close out those kinds of problems. We have by now corrected those things. That information is now not only provided to us, but we've asked our Inspector General to independently verify that that information is correct and to notify us should there be problems before that information is given to us by the general manager and his staff. So can you tell us a little bit more about how you feel in this balance between trying to be a policy-oriented board and not getting into too much detail and micromanaging, and in assuring safety, where you think we should be?
Thank you, and perhaps I might let my colleague, Member Wehner, who offered the amendment to identify the three steps that we believe that need to be taken, answer this question about where we think the board might need to go and how they could be more effective. The amendment was offered by Member Wehner in our board meeting and was unanimously adopted by all five board members. Dr. Wehner.
Thank you, Chairman Hirschman, for the opportunity, and thank you, the WMATA Board of Directors, for this opportunity to meet with you. I come from a background of 40-plus years in the aviation safety business, if you will. A good share of that was for a major airframe manufacturer, whom I'm sure all of you would recognize. It was a great chance to, if you will, professionally grow up in an environment whose business success depended solely, depended though in large part on the actual safety of the product as well as the perception of safety of the product. So safety was important to everybody. You know, the aviation field is littered with the bones of organizations who the public perceived as not being safe. So being an airframe manufacturer, you stay in business, as I said, because you are safe. That meant that safety became important to everybody from the bottom of the organization, people driving rivets, all the way to the president of the organization and the board of directors. Safety is a lot like quality. You know, I would love to be able to say, here's a toolkit, take this toolkit, implement it, and you will, in fact, be safe. Instead, it's more like quality. It comes when you develop within your organization a culture that everybody is responsible for safety. And that really means, in our case with the airframe manufacturer, not only in the design of the product, but the construction of the product and the operation of the product. In the case of WMATA, the traveling public expects a service, and they're going to look that that service is safe or is perceived to be safe. So it's a long answer. The answer is you have to have a safety culture. The safety culture starts at the top, a statement by the board of directors of WMATA that safety is important to them, enables a whole bunch of people underneath your whole organization to now take seriously safety. And it allows the whole organization to talk about safety because you folks are obviously interested in safety.
Okay. Ms. Hudgens.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I'd like to also extend my welcome and thank you for the opportunity to meet with you. I think as I saw the graphic again today, I think it is a highlight of the seriousness that I think not only your recommendations bring, but I think as the chairman's comments state, that I believe we are sincere, committed, and accept these recommendations as a critical part of how this WMATA organization should operate and what the expectations are for it into its future. Sitting in the NTSBS hearing, you provided a great deal of detail and of the analysis that was done. And we appreciate the role that our staffs have played in making the cooperation of getting to the through the investigative process through. But when you talked about what your culture experiences have been with safety, I think it was good to hear a great deal of that discussion. And I guess what I walked away, I actually Googled Dr. Reason to see where experiences come from. But I'd like for you, if you could talk in terms of where you anticipate or are good opportunities for us to look to in organizations, other transit properties, because I think many of us believe that we are sensitive and are participating in this board role with safety as one of our, it is one of our number one strategic goals. But we want to ensure that in taking this recommendation, we move forward with an understanding of the measurements that matter and that would prevent at any time us occur as seeing what occurred on the 22nd again. Thank you, Vice Chairman, and thank you for your interest in the Safety Board's work and for attending our board meeting last month. My colleague, Member Robert Sumwalt, has some experience in developing safety cultures within organizations, and so I'd like for him to respond to your comments and questions and maybe talk a little bit about Dr. Reason's model, too. Thanks.
Thank you very much. Yes, I've read and a good bit of Dr. Reason's work and applied it actually in a transportation industry. So I've thought a lot about this in preparation for today's meeting. What is a safety culture? And certainly I don't have the best definition in the world, but I say that safety culture is a set of established attitudes, values, beliefs, norms, and practices concerning safety. And it does start at the top of an organization and permeate throughout. And I think attributes of a safety culture, according to Dr. Reason and some of the work that we've done at the board, involve a number of things. First, data collection and analysis. As Dr. Reason would say, and he's written a book called Managing the Risk in Organizational Accidents, and the board did classify this WMATA accident as an organizational accident. But Dr. Reason says that an organization would collect and analyze the right kind of data to keep it informed of the safety health of an organization. It collects, analyzes, and disseminates information on incidents and near misses, as well as proactive safety checks. It would do that through a number of means, safety audits, internal and external audits, confidential incident reporting systems, quality assurance checks. So you've got to have means to keep your finger on the pulse of the operation and find out what's going on so that can signal to you, to you as the board of directors, the safety health of your organization. Another attribute of a safety culture would be an open reporting culture whereby employees can report safety violations and problems without fear of retaliation or discipline. Employees have to have the assurances that the information that they provide you with will be listened to. There's nothing that will shut down a flow of information quicker than two things. One would be if employees feel like, why am I going to the trouble to report these safety problems if no one does anything with it? And another problem that will shut down a flow of information from your employees is that if their confidentiality is not maintained or if they are ridiculed or punished for reporting to you. Another attribute of a safety culture would be what Dr. Reason defines as calls a just culture, which is really an atmosphere of trust where employees are encouraged, even rewarded, for providing safety-related information. If someone goes out and commits an honest mistake, pulls up a train an eight-car train at a six-car platform, do you want to discipline that employee for if he comes to you and says, this is what happened, when maybe it's a systems problem? If you discipline that employee, then you're going to shut down that flow of information. So if it's quote-unquote an honest mistake, a just culture would say, we don't want to discipline people for making those honest mistakes if they report them to them. But it's also not I'll use the term loosely, it's also not a get-out-of-jail-free card. If somebody, there's a line that is clearly established. If somebody commits an honest mistake, that behavior is tolerated because they're trying to help you. They're humans. They make mistakes. But on the other hand, if somebody egregiously doesn't follow the rules, then you can't tolerate that. So there's a clear line between acceptable and unacceptable behavior. And finally, I think there's got to be an organization with a safety culture has a clear focus on procedural compliance. The organizational has solid procedures, policies, procedures, and guidelines, and stresses strict compliance with them. And if the procedures aren't workable, there's a process for this feedback to get back to the management so that the procedure can be evaluated and possibly changed. But employees are not put in the position of having to do workarounds. So, Madam Vice Chairman, I hope that kind of gives you an idea there that there really are some things that an organization can do to begin the road towards that safety culture, and I also recognize that WMATA is already putting some of these things in place. So thank you very much for your very insightful questions.
I just wanted to comment and thank you because I thought those were very good comments that we heard. I thought another, and I may be pointing to Mr. Rosenkind, but I'm not clear, but it's something that is a continuous piece. That is, I think your comment was that if you believe you're already safe and working in a safety culture, you probably have already missed the boat. And those are not your quotes, my paraphrase of that. And I think that I appreciate your acknowledging the fact that WMATA has through its whistleblower program and the other actions that we've begun is beginning in that to reestablish more, I think, overtly what we believe is the culture in this organization. WMATA is known for its safety, its reliability, its quality services, and we want to continue in that framework.
I believe Mr. Albert also had a follow-up question for Mr. Sumwalt.
Thank you so much, Chairman Benjamin. And it is interesting to listen to actually the work of Dr. Reasons, but I have a question for the board. As you do your work, and I know WMATA is not the only transit system that you've analyzed, is there a model out there where the governing body of a transit transportation organization has embraced an enhanced safety culture that you would point the WMATA board to? Is there an entity or entities, it doesn't have to be one, that we should be looking at? Maybe there is, maybe it's a combination of a few, but I'd like some feedback on that.
Mr. Albert, unfortunately, in our business, the safety board usually investigates things that don't go well. And so we're not always looking at the people who are the leading or the best indicators in their particular industry. And so I would say most of our challenges come when we investigate accidents, identifying organizations that actually need to make some progress rather than organizations that are already there. But we do work with groups who look at high reliability and high performing organizations, and we'd be happy to provide you with some of that information. I know there's actually an event sponsored by the federal government about safety culture and high reliability organizations on Wednesday, and we have talked to them. If there are some attendees from the Metro Board that want to participate in that, there are going to be some people speaking about their experiences in developing a safety culture. And so we'd certainly be happy to follow up with you about some organizations that you might want to talk to that have undertaken some programs to get themselves into a better safety posture. We can give you some specifics today during the discussion about specific things that have been done, if you'd like.
Appreciate that.
Ms. Herzman, thank you. I did want to also point out, just so if you weren't taken by surprise, that although most of our board members are here today, we have additional ones so that the other three are listening on the telephone or listening to this simulcast, and they may call in and ask questions. So when that happens, I'll recognize somebody who's not in the room, and you will hear a disembodied voice. Don't be concerned. That's not typical for us, but in this very important event, we did want to make sure that everybody had an opportunity to ask questions. Mr. Downey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I want to thank the Safety Board for being here today. I've worked with the board in a lot of different capacities over the years. I actually watched the entire webcast last week, learned a lot from it, as I have from your work over the years. And I want to be, as other members have said, a real partner in moving ahead this organization, moving it towards the kind of safety culture that I have seen in other places and I've seen brought about in other places. So I completely agree with you. I think the important issue for me is what is the role of the board and how can we be effective in carrying that out? Many things you've already mentioned in terms of clear procedures, clear plans, I think we certainly are capable of doing. One of the first things I did when I came on the board was ask for the system safety plan, read it all. I wish we were carrying all of it out. I think if we were, we'd not be in some of the difficulty we are. A couple of things that did come up in the meeting I wanted to follow up on. One idea that was thrown out was, should there be a safety committee on the board? I did a little research. among other large transit agencies of the top 15. There is only one agency that, in fact, has such a committee. It's the Safety and Security Committee. And when I looked at their agendas, it didn't seem to me that they were really digging in hard, but at least they're there. I'm not sure it's as important where it resides as that it does the right thing and elevates issues to the board, not just those that are coming in from the outside, but as well those that are being developed within the organization that we should know about. A second point that came up, I think, from Member Sumwalt was a comment that the board might well initiate its own safety reviews. I may have misheard that, but I really would like to know what the thinking was there. I don't really feel I should be out checking track circuits, but it may come to the point where we should have independent advice on safety issues in order to make good judgments. And one other thing I wanted to get your reaction to, you are certainly in a position to keep the pressure on the federal government to elevate the role of the DOT and the Federal Transit Administration with respect to safety oversight and with respect to the structure that they create at the regional level to do that. I think it's very important. That should not be the ceiling of what we want to do, but if we had a clear floor of regulations and structure, we could then work from there. Right now, we do have to be out there kind of on our own, and I think it would be very helpful if, as in other modes of transportation, you could look to the federal standard as something that we start from, not necessarily end up at. But what should our role be, and how do we maintain dialogue on carrying it out effectively?
Well, Mr. Downey, as always, you've got a lot of thoughts there, and so I think our challenge is going to be making sure that we cross all the T's and dot all the I's on your questions. I think with respect to the FTA oversight, the Safety Board would be very consistent that this is not just a concern that we have about WMATA. It is a consistent concern that we've seen nationwide in investigations of other transit properties throughout the country. We know that the state safety oversight committees vary. Their performance varies. Their resources vary. Their enforcement and authority to aggressively pursue their findings vary from property to property and state to state, as do the requirements for builds for cars. And so the Safety Board has been on record for many years asking the FTA to seek additional authority in the areas of crashworthiness and developing crashworthiness standards for rail cars, looking at operational issues such as fatigue. Many people are surprised to find out that of the modal industries, the transit industry is one of the few, especially with many of the split shifts that get worked by your employees, that don't have rules for hours of service. And this is unlike what we see in the trucking, aviation, and rail industries. We think that FTA oversight would establish that floor. And we certainly encourage every operation to go beyond that. But you need those minimums for requirements for event recorders on trains, emergency access and emergency egress, crashworthiness standards of cars. That should not inherently be something that each engineering department has to develop on their own. There needs to be crash testing performed. Metro should not need to do that. That is inherently a function of the federal government to establish those standards, and we think that that's an area where they could provide you a bit of a safety net, so to speak, to give you the basis for some of the decisions that you make. With respect to what we think you all could do, I think our recommendation, the tripartite recommendation, looking at your mission statement, looking at safety metrics, and looking at the reviews that other entities do, NTSB, TOC, FTA, APTA audits. There's a lot of information that comes into you, and I think this dovetails with another portion of your question. I don't think that we expect you all to initiate your own investigations. We understand the challenges that you have with respect to your time and your background and your expertise, but we do expect you all, consistent with your system safety plan, to hold the operations accountable to the findings of those other independent audits. Those are a sound check for you all to get information that you might not possess, and you need to be able to hold the operations, the general manager, the safety department accountable for, are they complying with those open recommendations? Are they complying with the findings from the TOC? Many of those findings have remained open for years and years without action, and ultimately, that's something that you have the ability to hold them accountable for. I'll defer to Member Sumwalt, since there was a specific comment about a safety subcommittee.
Thank you, and certainly I agree with Chairman Herzman that we do not expect the members of the Board of Directors to go out and walk the tracks and conduct the inspections. But what we did notice in our investigation was that in the WMATA Board of Directors charter, there is no mention whatsoever about safety at all.
And that should be changed immediately.
I'm sorry?
I said that should be changed immediately.
I second that, but sorry. The issue of when you combine safety with customer service, operations, and safety, you're making safety compete with those other things. We all know there's the age-old conflict between production and safety. And one of the safety committee meetings that I listened to right before our public hearing, which was in February, in that particular meeting, there was a discussion about, well, our on-time performance is deteriorating now that we're running in a manual mode, now that we're having to go to manual and absolute block and all of these other things, and our on-time performance is deteriorating. Should we go back to an auto mode? And certainly that is a decision that the overall board needs to weigh, but when you're trying to discuss those things within the context of a safety committee meeting, we at the NTSB, we're an independent board. That's all we want to look at is safety. And so it could possibly trump customer service and operations could be trumping your safety concerns. If safety was a standalone committee, then they could feel free to go and do the things that they need to do to make sure that safety remains looked at properly in that committee and then brought to the full committee. And I think you know that you're managing safety properly when you're managing safety just as you are managing other vital business functions like finance and customer service and those kinds of things. But until safety is managed like a vital business function, you're probably not on the right road. Thank you.
Actually, I'd like to pick up on that, because one of the key issues is a trade-off, Mr. Sumwalt, that you just talked about. It's the inherent conflict between operations and safety, between production and safety. Clearly, the safest system we could operate would be one that would have no passengers, no buses, and no trains, because then nobody would be injured on any of the vehicles. So the minute we open our first station, run our first train, or drive our first bus, we are, in fact, compromising ultimate safety. And that's inherent and a requirement in order to provide service. And so what you're trying to do now is say, in order to provide the ends of mobility, we can't have a perfectly safe system, but how safe can we make it? And that's the really difficult challenge. I'd like to put this in the context of our 1,000 series cars. And I believe, Chairman Herzman, you mentioned the fact that riding transit is many times safer than driving an automobile. And the 1,000 series cars, in fact, represent a quarter of our fleet. Were we to retire that, and as you know, we have already ordered replacements for them, but it's going to be several years before they are all here and running. If we were to retire 1,000 series cars right now, during a rush hour, one quarter of the people probably wouldn't be able to travel or something approaching that. To the degree that they then used automobiles, chances are more people would be killed and injured than if they continued to ride in the 1,000 series cars. So we're faced with a very difficult trade-off here. Do you have any hints as to how we should deal with that?
Well, I think that's the difference between potentially our two boards, is you have to manage many factors, and safety is one of those, and you have to figure out how to prioritize that. We don't share that same burden We look at safety, and we make recommendations about what we think is in the best interest of the traveling public, and our sole function is looking at safety issues. We have recognized for many years that the crashworthiness of the older series of cars has been a concern. As you know, we investigated an accident at Woodley Park in 2004 where we made this recommendation. The best news that we heard right before the board meeting was that you had actually been able to make that buy from Kawasaki for those 7,000 series cars. We think that is a great step in the right direction. We recognize the challenges that you have balancing your resources and also balancing your priorities of service on the one hand and safety on the other hand. We believe that those 1,000 series cars still represent a risk to the traveling public, and so that's why we made our recommendation. But we do recognize the progress, the significant progress that you all have made in moving ahead with that buy to replace those cars with better, more robust, safer cars. And we look forward to the day that we get to ride on them.
As do we. And so what you're telling us is it's up to us to make that trade between driving people back to automobiles and the potential that they will have accidents there, which is much higher than if they're on our rail system, and continuing to operate those cars until we can replace them. That's what you see as our issue that we've got to deal with.
I think it's definitely a challenge that that the board has to deal with. But as I mentioned in the board meeting, in Metro's 30-plus year history, there have been 13 fatalities, and we lose that same number of people every 2 weeks on our highways in the Washington area. And so we know that there are risks inherent with every mode of transportation. But we believe that if you were to implement many of the recommendations that we've issued from our investigations and from the Fort Totten investigation, that that would reduce the likelihood of having an accident. The crashworthiness is the last piece of this. You want to not have an accident in the first place, and then you want to have a crashworthy car if something happens. If you fall through all of those layers of safety, you want to have the most robust vehicle you can. And we've made recommendations about that in all modes of transportation. But I think if you implement many of the recommendations that we've issued already about operations and detection, communication, we can hopefully avert in a situation where we have to identify crashworthiness again.
Your point is well taken. Mr. Zimmerman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And thank you, Chairman Herzman. I appreciate very much your giving us this time and this opportunity for us to better understand so we can better implement the recommendations that you've made and continue to work as to the goal that we all share here of making Metro as safe as it is humanly possible to do. I have a couple of different questions, but I'd like to start with a clarification on something I'm not sure I have understood properly. In the discussion from what I've read prior today and in your opening presentation of the specific cause of the June 22nd, 2009 collision, one of the things that I'm maybe a little confused on is whether the circuit failure that you're describing is best understood as part of the system of automatic train control or automatic train protection?
I think we have some supporting slides that we can bring up to show you maybe if you could move to the track circuit slides that are towards the end. I think that the concern that we have is that there was a loss to identify the detection of the train. And so when we looked at what happened, and I have to say we were on site for an unprecedented 6 weeks with Metro working together to try to identify some of the concerns. Many of the things that we did during that time on site led us to some of the additional recommendations that we made in this accident investigation. But ultimately, the detection failed. If you look, this is an unoccupied track circuit that works. If you look at the next slide, you'll see this is an occupied track circuit that works. It's making sure that there's a recognition that the train is there. And if you look at the next slide, You'll see that here was the situation where the circuit failed to detect the train in the circuit. One of the concerns that we had was that Metro had seen this before, and in particular we looked back to two near collisions that occurred underneath the river near Roslyn, and the challenge in that situation was that they really fully didn't identify what caused the failure. But the good news is that the engineering department did come up with a test to try to detect it in the future. The problem was when the engineering department came up with that test and handed it off to the maintenance department didn't propagate and implement that test consistently, and it was called a three-shunt test, basically where you're testing either end in the middle.
And
so they weren't doing all three. And every time we ran that three-shunt test after the accident, we failed, and this was with Metro technicians, to detect the presence of the train. And so there was certainly that issue, but the other issue was that there was some alarms that were going off in the control center. And Jane, if you could go back to the photo of the control center, I know all of the Metro board members have visited the control center, but there were thousands of alarms going off. If you could go back one to the control, there were thousands of alarms that were going off every week, actually hundreds of thousands of alarms going off every week in the center of all types. But the ones that we were most concerned about were the failure to detect the presence of a train when there actually was a train there, and then the ones that said a train was there when it wasn't. And so we were having real concerns about the vitality of the system, about the trust that the employees placed in it, and about the failure to recognize that these alarms were a concern. The failure to detect a train when the block was occupied ultimately was a minor alarm, and it became self-canceling after a period of time. And so this test shows that there wasn't a recognition that there was a problem here. If the employees think that it's the software that's failing and they're not going to use the system, then you need to do something about that system and change it so it's helpful to them. So I think there are many issues with respect to the train protection and the train control system, but all of these were within really Metro's grasp to identify, and this goes back to those, using the right information to make the right decisions. And we hope that this accident will help to change things. I can tell you that I have visited some other properties, other transit properties in the last year. They have learned so much from this accident. Many of them have changed the way that they're investing in their systems and what they do on their properties because of what happened on Metro. And so people are making changes.
Well, that actually gets to my second question, which was how the architecture of the system with regard to the particular system that you're talking about here, how that compares with those of others in the industry. And I mean both in the sense of, what's typical. Is the way our system was designed, which, the shortcomings of which you've documented, was that like an outlier, or is it typical of what's, what we find in other systems? And then even more importantly, what are the best practices? In other words, what are the agencies out there that have the system designed the way it should be that we should be looking to as the model?
And I apologize because generally we're not looking at the people who are doing the best. Sometimes what we look at is organizations who have tripped or organizations who have failed, and we identify their shortcomings. But we'd be happy to put you in touch with some folks who can do that. But we do know that there are some principles associated with some of these systems. Each system is a little bit unique, each transit system, and if you're talking about the system, I'm not sure if you mean the track circuitry or if you mean the operations control center system.
Well, let's talk specifically on the track circuitry that failed. Do you know of any system that is operating now that has the system structured the way it ought to be? In other words, is there another one out there you know of that you say, well, that's the way you should be doing it?
Each system is a little bit different, and the way that they operate is perfectly acceptable if they're doing it within their standards and high levels of safety. So there's some transit systems that are of the same generation as the WMATA system.
Right.
They don't operate in exactly the same way as WMATA. They don't have the same exact setup. So they might have two signals on their track system instead of one the way Metro has. It's each one is a little bit different. It's kind of like a boutique shopping. It's not like you're going to Walmart and you're pulling off the shelf. You know, everybody's doing the same thing. They're tailored a little bit different for their operations, but they do have, we do have some best practices that we're familiar with. And I think Member Rosekind, maybe what you could do is help to talk about some of the challenges associated with automation and also with train operators, but also in the control center and some of the lessons that we've learned there.
It's, your questions raise all these great challenges, and what you're already hearing is there's not always one answer for everybody. And so a guiding principle that I'll give you, though, is technology offers great promise. One of the critical pieces is having human-centered technology or automation. And the reason for that is humans have to design it, they have to operate it, they have to monitor it, and they have to maintain it. And I think what you've done is just experience where instead of the technology being a tool, and the alarm question's already come up, that it became ignored because it stopped providing information, for example. So it's actually not about the volume of alarms. It has to do with their clarity, their meaning. When I get that alarm, what do I do because of it? So as a guiding principle, whatever system you want to look at, whether it's yours or trying to find something comparable, is the technology that's in use, is it built, designed, maintained around the humans? And that's really critical because I think we look so often now for the technology to get the human out of the loop. Mm-hmm. Let's not enter that human error. And in fact, the human is really core to it. So as a guiding principle, I would say if you think of human-centered, you know, technology and automation as you go forward or evaluate these other systems, that would be a guiding principle, thinking about it, again, from design, operation, monitoring, and the maintenance part of it.
I think this points to the earlier point that Chairman Herzman was making about the need for national standards, because part of the difficulty here is that everything is one-off and boutique, and that's got to only compound the difficulties in managing safety everywhere and having, you know, reliable and safe systems. Let me finally ask you about, and this takes a little bit more to what the board needs to do. One of the things you've talked about is appropriate safety performance metrics, and this is something that's been of interest to me all across the board, not only on safety, but on all the issues on which we have oversight responsibility, because I think that it's vital that we have metrics and we have the right metrics in order for a policy board to be determining that an agency is carrying out its function appropriately. So my question is, how do we develop appropriate safety performance metrics? We certainly have had, we've had lots of metrics. You know, we've over the years always had reviews of performance in a lot of different areas, many of which are related to safety. The question is, are you picking the right things? Because to generate data, you know, all kinds of data can be generated. But are you establishing the right things that get you the performance you want? And that, in any area, that can be a challenge to do. It's particularly challenging in an area that's very technical, in which, you know, the policy board doesn't necessarily have the expertise. And one of the things I've been struggling with is, how do we find, how do we identify, how do we develop, where do we look for, again, on their best practices, so that we say, instead of, you know, if you have 500 different things, you're not doing anything. You've got to pick what the subset is of things that you're going to establish as what you're measuring and reporting on. And that, I think, is the big trick, is to get that right set of things and then be able to monitor and follow through, as you said. Can you help us with that at all?
Well, we can try. And you haven't heard from the vice chairman yet, and so he has some experience with driving down safety accidents in other modes of transportation. And so I'm going to let him talk about his experience with the CAS program and non-punitive reporting systems.
Thank you, Chairman Herbst. That's a very good question that a lot of people ask, and as with Member Wehner, most of my experience is in aviation safety. That's where I've spent most of my time. One of the big issues in aviation safety is what is our metric of safety, because they can go years without a crash, and so they obviously measuring it based on crashes is not a very granular way to measure it. One of the ways that they are doing it, and the reference that the chairman made to CAS, is the Commercial Aviation Safety Team. One of the ways that they are doing it derives from the information they get from what I will loosely call non-punitive reporting systems. So let me just mention a word about those, because that provides very valuable information to help you get much more granular metrics rather than waiting for something to go wrong. In most complex transportation systems, Generally, when something goes wrong, the issue is not just did the human mess up, but this is, as Member Rosenkind said, is a system issue, and usually the issue is a relationship between the humans and the system and the interactions between the humans and the system. So typically, if there's a problem, it's typically not the human messed up. It's typically that the interaction between the human and the system didn't go the way it was supposed to. So what frontline information systems are intended to do is to help provide information, not to you, because this would be more micro level than you would typically look at, but help provide information to the system about how well those interactions between the human and the system are working or not working without waiting for a mishap to tell you that something is going wrong. And this is especially the case when, as Member Rosenkind mentioned, when you get new technologies, ideally the new technologies are designed to be human-centered in the first place, hopefully with the ultimate operators involved in the design process. But failing that, if you get the equipment and it's not as human-centered as you want, then that's when you really need a quick feedback system to tell you from the frontline operators that things aren't working the way they ought to. And the goal of these systems is twofold. One is to make the system less likely to cause human error in the first place, and two is, assuming there will always be human error as long as there are humans in the system, to try to make the system as tolerant of error as possible without catastrophic consequence. So let me, having said that, let me just say that I use the term non-punitive advisedly because it does not, as Member Sumwalt said, it does not mean get out of jail free. If the behavior is egregious enough, then I think we would all agree that punishment is warranted. So if we got drinking on the job, if we got alcohol abuse, we got things like that on the job, I think we would agree that punishment is warranted. The trick is how do you draw the line between where the punishment will occur and where the punishment isn't. This, again, I would refer back to CAS, the Commercial Aviation Safety Team, to tell how they did it in aviation, because this is a very tricky issue. The way they did it in aviation was they reviewed the information from their frontline programs with three parties present. The labor was present, the management was present, and the regulator was present, because all three of those have a dog in the fight. So all three of them looked at that information, and collectively they drew that line to decide where should punishment occur and where should punishment not occur. The vast, vast majority of problems that we see with human error are people trying to do the right thing in sometimes difficult circumstances as opposed to people trying to do the wrong thing. If they are trying to do the right thing under difficult circumstances, I would say the punishment is probably not warranted. So if you see people who are, remember, some often it's important to have procedural compliance. If you see people who are repeatedly not following procedure, then you have to ask yourself the question, is it because the people are bad or because the procedure is bad? And the information program from the front line will help you discern what the problem is, and then that will also help you to discern when and how to fix that problem. What this ultimately does, if you can develop one, and this is where the board comes in. It's important for the board to establish the policy of safety in the sense that will create an environment in which a reporting system can be created in which the employees trust the people they're going to talk to, because if they don't trust the people they're providing that information to, they simply will not, and the system will dry up. I heard reference to a whistleblower program. Usually the existence of a whistleblower program implies that there is not a normal daily mechanism for information to flow about problems in the system. Instead, you have to go to sort of a quasi-emergency mechanism, i.e. the whistleblower program. That in itself shows that there may not be a strong enough emphasis on voluntarily, regularly, frequently reporting about issues in the front line that could create safety problems.
Where can I go to find out more about the implementation of a non-punitive reporting system?
The first place I would suggest would be the aviation system itself, the CAST website, Commercial Aviation Safety Team. But there are other industries that are doing that as well now, following on the aviation example, and I could certainly give you some other citations, other places to look, but that's certainly where I'd start.
Thank you very much.
Sure.
Ms. Hewlett, I'm sorry.
Mr. Zimmerman, I might add, I know sometimes we talk in kind of theoretical and generalities, and so I thought it might be good to give you a couple of real-world examples of what we're talking about with respect to this. And also, just know that the regulator is involved in many of these programs, and so that's another area where you have a bit of a gap within your industry. And so for learning to be shared across properties and to be shared not just what you've learned here on Metro, but maybe what other systems are learning so you don't have to learn those mistakes, you do need some way to facilitate that information flow. It doesn't have to be through the regulator. It could be through APTA or another organization, but I think that that is helpful, not to get just learning on your property. We've seen this develop for pilots with the aviation safety action program, with for air traffic controllers, with the ATSAP program, it's like the ASAP program, and the railroad industry is also doing this, and it's called the Close Call reporting program or reporting system. And so there are a number of industries that are doing this. It's mature and it's successful, and they can share some examples with you. Let me share two aviation examples with you to show you exactly what Vice Chairman Hart's talking about. Last fall, we investigated two incidents. They weren't accidents, they were incidents. They were 2 days apart. One involved two flight crew members, Northwest 188. They overflew Minneapolis by about an hour. They didn't by about 100 miles. They didn't respond to air traffic control hailing them for over an hour. They had pulled out their laptops. They were working on their laptops, assessing some scheduling procedures, but they weren't being attentive to their responsibilities. The company also had a policy, an internal policy, that you could not use electronic devices on the flight deck, unauthorized, non-work-related electronic devices. Just within a day or so of that happening, we had an airline, Delta aircraft, coming in from South America, and they landed on the taxiway instead of the runway at Atlanta Hartsfield Airport, one of the busiest airports. No injuries or fatalities. We wanted to know, why did that crew land on the taxiway instead of the runway? There were some lighting issues. The lights weren't turned on the runway. There were lights on the taxiway. There was a change of runway assignment late in the process. And there was a sick crew member who went back. A lot of learning to go on there. One, the Northwest 188 overflight was not accepted into the system as a non-punitive event. Those two pilots were disciplined. They had enforcement action taken against them because they violated procedures. The other one, they didn't do it. It was an honest mistake, as Member Sumwalt mentioned, and there was a lot to learn from that. What does Delta need to learn about that? What do all of the other carriers around the country need to learn from that? What did Atlanta Hartsfield need to learn from that? And we want to get that information and change operations. You're asking, how does this apply to the transit industry? We don't have the same experiences. Well, I visited with one transit property this past year, and they, I know that you all have your share of escalator woes, and so let me share with you an escalator story. They explained to me that they had a problem with an escalator slip, and they had a reported event where the escalator slipped. And I said, well, how does this happen? And they looked back, and they had not had any problems with this before, and they were talking about it, and a number of their escalator technicians said, yeah, this happens all the time. We've seen it happen all the time. It's just that nobody ever got hurt. And the management said, what do you mean you've seen this happen all the time and nobody's ever gotten hurt? And they said, well, it's happened, but we have a form for filing this. We have a form for reporting that. And it didn't really fit into one of those categories. Well, somebody needed to know that they were having those escalator slips. And so that property got on that, and they said, whoa, we need to collect some information from our employees to avoid having a future event. And so that's kind of what this information collection is about, to feed back into the system, to give you some information so you don't have problems in the future. A lot of the information you can get may not be an accident or an incident or an injury, but it could prevent something like that from happening if you use that information to change procedures or policies or encourage behavior changes. Does that kind of help make it a little more solid for you?
Yeah, thanks very much.
Thanks.
Ms. Hewlett.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I'd like to thank the board, National Transportation Board members, all of you, for coming down today as well. This has been very, very eye-opening for many reasons, not just your hearings, but the reports, but even the exchange today has clarified a lot of issues for me as well. At the outset, I'd have to comment on the animation that I saw. I saw it with a heavy heart, because not only was it a recreation of the accident, the June 22nd accident, in which people were injured and lives were lost. And I know the hearts of this collective board and our WMATA family still go out to the families of the victims and the loved ones of the victims. But I couldn't... But I also looked at it, and as Train 112 was rounding the bend and to see approaching Train 214, which had was not supposed to be there according to the signals, I couldn't help but think, oh my goodness, this is what our heroine, Janice McMillan, saw. And she was the only one, as far as I can tell, who probably saw that at that moment. And I that was really pretty gut-wrenching for me and probably for all of us. And our hearts still continue to go out to her family as well. I think we're all trying to wrap our arms around the many, many factors that the confluence of factors that came together to contribute to some of these problems. And I think we've learned more about spurious signals and parasitic oscillation and all the other factors that came into play to on that awful day. I thank Mr. Weiner for that three-part challenge that you drafted and gave to the board, because that's imperative for us to really be more hands-on. And while we talked about, since I've been on the board, even before the accident, we always emphasize safety as a priority. As the priority, actually, for WMATA. But I think our responsibility is greater still. We have to continue to, we can't just state it, we have to live it, we have to breathe it, we have to demand it, we have to emphasize it, and to make it happen. So I think we will be, in answer to our chairman's question some time ago, some people say we're too hands-on, and so be it. We'll just have to be more hands-on to ensure that this happens. So I thank you for all that you've brought, that you've mentioned. I think Mr. Sumwalt also talked about making sure that there's a reporting system. And, you know, we talked about the whistleblower protection, and it is a protection. It's not. It's just to make sure that people have, that our employees feel safe in reporting things. And more people can report. And it's not just for their protection and so that they feel safe and so that they that no harm comes to them, but also, and not only to protect their confidentiality, which you mentioned, but also to make sure that they feel heard. I mean, nothing is more discouraging than someone to keep bringing something to your attention and it falls on deaf ears. We have to make sure we have no deaf ears. We have to wear hearing aids. There will be no deaf ears anymore. I think that was really important. And actually, on June 22nd, 2010, 1 year to the day after the accident, I went to the local 689 evening ceremonies where they were. We had the families there, and I was listening to the many, many employees talk about bringing safety issues to the concerns of WMATA. And to her credit, the president, Local 689 president, Ms. Jeter, emphasized very, very strongly that safety, the responsibility for safety lies with everyone. So she was drilling it down there, but I got up and spoke as well, too, because some people talked about passing on information that was in fact falling, from their perspective, falling on deaf ears, and we cannot allow that. So I think that's a very, very important component of it, too. I'm also glad that at least some good things are coming out of this. We are more focused, but all around the nation, people are looking at this. The other transit systems around the nation are looking at what happened and learning from this, and learning, too, about what the tests that have to be done, the monitoring that has to be done, and expecting those circuits. And probably with this there, but for the grace of God go I, thought that's in the front of their forefront of their head. So I think that's really good from a national perspective, too, that everyone's learning from what happened here. I think Mr. Benjamin asked a question that I had about the 1000 series, and you answered it. You said that's not one of the issues that you have to juggle with in terms of if we lose 1/4 of our fleet. But I heard, Ms. Hurston, I heard you mention that you were concerned about the crash crashworthiness of some of our series, and I don't know if that was limited to the 1,000 series or did it go beyond the 1,000 series. If you can address that for me.
Jane, can you pull up the Woodley Park and photos? Obviously, the Safety Board is on record making recommendations in the past, the one before that. With respect to the crashworthiness, we know that the fatalities in the Fort Totten accident occurred when that lead car, the striking train, telescoped into the standing train. That was a 1,000 series into a 5,000 series car, and that the result that you saw in Fort Totten. In 2006, following our 2004 investigation in Woodley Park, we made specific recommendation to Metro to accelerate the removal of the 1,000 series cars, because that was already in your plans that you would replace them. But as we know, there are a lot of financial challenges, and that did not come to pass until after the Fort Totten accident. And so we do have specific recommendations on the 1,000 series cars. But if you go back to an older accident that you all had in Shady Grove and involved a 3,000 series car, we also saw telescoping in that accident. And so I would say that this goes back to that recommendation that Federal Transit Administration really needs to establish minimum baseline crashworthiness standards nationwide for all fleets that are purchased. We do know that each subsequent, and if you'll go to the next slide, Jane, this goes to the issue of bellying the 1,000 series cars. I just thought it would be good to share this with you. There's a reason why we continue to say the 1,000 series cars are a concern in our report. This involved the collision in November 2009 in the yard at West Falls Church, and this was a very low-speed collision, about 15 miles an hour, and these were the bellied 1,000 series cars, standing train, and the 1,000 series cars damage that we saw. So, again, it was significant.
So the belly doesn't work.
We found that the bellying is not sufficient, and it was not supported by an engineering analysis from WMATA. But to go back to your question, I do think that we have concerns. We asked in 1996 for Metro to look at the crashworthiness of their car fleet and determine whether or not they could fortify it or retrofit it. The subsequent models, especially 4,000 onward, have significant better as far as crashworthiness standards go. They have performance standards that look better, but without those crashworthiness standards and some testing, I think it's still kind of a question that everyone can't answer definitively.
Thank you. And as you see, we are, you said you're very pleased there that we are endeavoring to do just that as soon as possible to purchase more crashworthy vehicles, but you trains. But you also said that ideally you just don't have the accident in the first place. That's the first priority. That's the type of safety to make sure that we get these other things under control. But in the event that we do have an accident, it's imperative that we have crashworthy cars. And at least in our quest to implement all of the recommendations that you all have made, I think that that is one that is that we're working on diligently. It's just that it will take time, as you see, because it takes a long time for us to get the cars. So. And the crashworthiness will be much, much better. Thank you.
And this board has definitely stated its support for legislation to give authority to the Federal Transit Administration to establish standards throughout the rail transit industry. We are aware of the fact that you are also doing three additional reviews, and we are hoping very much that we won't have this meeting with you three more times, that we will in fact be making progress and that you will recognize that at the time of the incidents that you are reviewing, we had not made as much progress as we are now, and that you will also recognize that that progress is being made. Relative to that, I did want to mention a few of the things that we as a board and we as an authority have done, and then call on our general manager to talk about some of the ways that...
I have a comment.
Okay, just a minute. Our general manager to respond to talk about some of the ways that we have
already responded and are responding to some of your recommendations. As a starter, we did used to have a board safety committee. As a matter of fact, Carlton Sickles, one of the founders of Metro, chaired it for about 25 years, and we will recreate our board safety committee. Our authority has stabilized and strengthened the Office of Safety with a new director who is sitting over there, who reports directly to the general manager, and we've augmented the staff. So we have a stronger and more effective safety office. That director of safety does report to this board on safety on a monthly basis. The Tri-State Oversight Committee is now reporting to this board on a quarterly basis. So we are hearing from both of those. And to double check, as I mentioned before, we've asked our Inspector General to review regularly the internal and external safety reports, the progress that's being made in carrying out the recommendations, and to let us know if there are any issues, any delays, any problems. We will revise Metro's mission statement, and we will revise the board procedures to underscore our commitment to safety, as you have stated. As you know, in January, we requested assistance from the U.S. Department of Transportation, from the FFL-CIO, and from the American Public Transportation Association in changing Metro safety culture, because we recognized very early that that was, in fact, one of the major issues, if not the major issue, in establishing a safe organization. They have helped us to select a team of consultants, external consultants, who are experts in the field of safety culture and safety as it's been implemented not only in transit, but across transportation modes. And they are hard at work already. They're working with us, and they are not going to just write a report and walk away. They are going to help us implement a change in safety culture, which we recognize will take time, but it will allow us to make sure that we as an organization don't just talk safety, that we live safety, and that safety is the key element of what we do throughout. We have already conducted an authority-wide survey of our staff to find out how they perceive safety and what is going on throughout this organization. And I believe we have about a 97% participation rate. So we are getting a lot of information as to whether our employees see safety as a goal and what is standing in the way of making it what we want it to be. We have established a safety hotline. We are creating a safety issues tracking system to provide a lot of the information that you've been talking about here. We have an internal task force that reviewed and revised our operating procedures to make sure that those were effective and useful and that people would not ignore them as they move forward. Obviously, there's more to do after you've revised them. You have to make sure that people follow them. But their objective here was to make sure that they're the kinds of things that allow the people to get their work done, but to do it safely. We have, as we mentioned, approved the contract to replace the 1,000 series cars, and we have strengthened Metro's whistleblower protection policy and made sure that that information is being disseminated throughout the organization to encourage people to come forward with any problems that they may see. We've approved a multi-year capital budget, which focuses on safety, rehabilitation, replacement, and the state of good repair of our system. I'd like to ask the general manager to speak a little bit more specifically about some of the very detailed recommendations you've made and how we're moving forward on those.
Mr. Chairman, may I make a comment before you call in the general manager?
No, you can do it after the general manager, though. Mr. Sarles.
Chairman Benjamin, Chairman Hurston, members of the WMATA board and the NTSB safety boards. I appreciate the opportunity to brief you on the progress Metro has made in response to the NTSB recommendations we received 2 weeks ago. On July 27th, I and members of Metro's executive leadership team were in attendance listening carefully to the NTSB board meeting proceedings and to gain a full understanding of the findings and recommendations. We deeply appreciate the deliberation and careful analysis that went into the investigation, and are committed to following through on each recommendation, as well as learning from the NTSB's observations and findings. Immediately following the NTSB board meeting, we set out to address each of the 16 recommendations. Within 24 hours of that meeting, I assembled Metro's senior leadership team and have met with them regularly since then to begin developing a plan to act upon each and every recommendation as quickly as possible. I'd like to walk through the actions that we're taking in response to each of the NTSB recommendations. First, with respect to the recommendations to the Metro Board to revise policies and processes to further codify and improve safety oversight of Metro, staff is ready to implement your direction on a revised policy statement on board's oversight of system safety. We are also prepared to join you in amending our mission statement to reflect the board and management's renewed commitment to safety. Additionally, as you previously directed, the Chief Safety Officer will report monthly to the board on our safety progress to date, including responsiveness and compliance with safety oversight agencies such as the NTSB. The NTSB made two recommendations intended to reduce the potential parasitic oscillation in track circuits. We've already replaced all the modules at 34 locations in the system. We are in the process of replacing 8 more and are planning to replace modules at the remaining 61 locations. We will soon present a full XDI replacement plan to our board. With respect to inspection of track circuit modules, beginning in November, we will increase the frequency of our inspections on audio frequency track circuit modules within the rail system from annual to quarterly inspections. We will continue the loss of shunt review twice daily until the testing is completed on the real-time alert system and we can implement it. In response to a recommendation to improve the dissemination of safety-related information, we have developed a cross-functional committee to develop procedures that ensure clear communication and document receipt of all technical bulletins and other safety-related information. We will begin to put these procedures in place within the next 60 days. The next recommendation from the NTSB addressed the need to remove the unnecessary communication equipment along the wayside that may interfere with automatic train control system. We are currently working to identify all locations throughout the rail system where unnecessary wayside communication equipment exists and are developing a plan to disable and or remove it. We anticipate beginning the first phase of removal by December. There are two recommendations related to the automatic train control system to conduct a complete analysis of foreseeable failures and to address the findings of that analysis. At the board's direction, we have retained an independent firm who can perform a rigorous safety analysis of the automatic train control system and provide recommendations to address potential failures identified as a result of the analysis. We are presently working to develop the scope, schedule, and budget for the project. The NTSB also recommended that cable insulation resistance testing become part of our periodic maintenance requirements. A schedule is being developed to perform nightly cable insulation resistant testing as part of a larger comprehensive cabling maintenance review. We will provide the board with additional information on the testing schedule. The NTSB recommended that we, in cooperation with the Tri-State Oversight Committee, address the findings of the March 4, 2010 FTA audit. I'm pleased to report that we have submitted our initial response from the recent FTA audit to the Tri-State Oversight Committee in April, and provide an update on our activity to TOC and the FTA's Office of Safety and Security last week. We will submit our status report to the FTA and the TOC before the August 30th deadline. An additional recommendation was that we review data from onboard recorders and trains and the Advanced Information Management System. Senior staff meets monthly to review data on reliability, maintenance, and engineering, and then to develop trend analyses. We will include a review of the data from onboard recorders installed in rail cars in these meetings. Local 689 union representatives have agreed to participate in the meetings as well. The NTSB recommended the establishment of a non-punitive safety reporting program to collect incident reports from across Metro and share the review of those incident reports across the entire organization. With regard to this recommendation, as was already noted, the Board of Directors took the first step by strengthening authorities' whistleblower protection policy. Management has also established a safety hotline for employees to anonymously report safety concerns. But as you noted, we want to encourage employees further and ensure that they identify and report problems. To that end, we have initiated discussions with Local 689 to establish a procedure and program for the reporting of near misses without punitive consequences. The NTSB made two recommendations related to the evaluation of risk and the resolution of corrective actions. In September, Metro's Executive Safety Committee, which was previously established as a Standing Safety Committee, will review hazard identification and hazard management. This process will be included in the System Safety Program Plan. Further, as part of the monthly meetings, the Executive Committee will review safety audits, open corrective action plans, and take the necessary steps to adequately address the corrective actions in a timely manner. The NTSB recommended that Metro remove the 1,000 series rail cars from service as soon as possible and replace them with rail cars that are comparable to the 6,000 series rail cars in terms of crash worthiness. As was noted before, a few weeks ago, our board of directors approved a contract to replace the 1,000 series cars, which are the oldest cars in the fleet, with new generation 7,000 series rail cars. The new cars will be equipped with advanced crash worthiness technology. We will also examine the service and safety impacts of removing the 1,000 series cars from service or other operational alternatives and report back to the board. The final two recommendations call for ensuring that the lead married pair rail car set in each train has an operating onboard event recorder and that we develop a maintenance program for our onboard recorders. We're developing a plan to equip the 4,000 and 1,000 series with onboard event recorders. The 2,000, 3,000, 5,000, 6,000 series cars are already equipped with event recorders. The enhanced maintenance criteria of the onboard event recorders will be incorporated in the preventive maintenance and inspection process beginning in November. In the upcoming years, Metro faces a number of challenges, and we appreciate the Metro Board has already dedicated $30 million over the next 3 years in our capital budget to begin addressing the NTSB recommendations, and has retained a team of experts, as noted before, to examine and make recommendations on WMATA's safety culture. Metro staff is ready to meet these challenges in cooperation with the FTA, the NTSB, the Tri-State Oversight Committee, and our other safety partners, and under leadership of the Metro Board. Thank you.
Mr. Graham has indicated a desire to be recognized.
I want to thank Ms. Hewlett for reminding us all of the great human element of this, because I was the chairman of the board when this accident occurred, and I was on this site within 1 hour of the collision. Chairperson Hirschman, I know you arrived very, very shortly thereafter. And so the impact of all of this in terms of its the human tragedy was apparent to me very early on, and seeing the graphic displays of this brings it all back very clearly to my mind and to my emotions. I agree with you, Chairperson Hirschman, that we've got to move ahead. We have got to figure out the solutions, and then we've got to find the money necessary to achieve and obtain those solutions. I am proud of this board because before the accident on June 22nd, this board had already issued an RFP. We were reviewing the responses to that RFP for new rail cars weeks before this accident occurred. It was a $1 billion price tag associated with these rail cars. And as you and your fellow members have pointed out, it is not your responsibility to figure out how to achieve all of this. You are focused most appropriately on the issues of safety and making those observations, conclusions, and recommendations. But, you know, and I've listened with great interest to all of the comments on safety culture. I got to say, as one of the members of this board for the longest period now, that this agency had a good safety culture. As has been pointed out, Carlton Sickles chaired the safety committee. We had not had a passenger fatality since 1982. And so on the day before this accident, I think if you would have asked any member of this board, was safety important, we would have said absolutely, and we've got a great record.
The other thing, but with that said, I take to heart all of what you've said about improving the safety culture. But at the core of this June 22nd tragedy is a technology failure. And I don't want to lose sight of that. It was a technology failure. It was the fact that a circuit sent a message that there was no train on the track to an oncoming train, which proceeded on the assurance that there was no train on the track, and this great collision occurred. And at that time, and I've thought a lot about this, no one knew about this failure. The people who had repaired that circuitry 5 days earlier didn't know. This board didn't know. The driver didn't know. No member of the Metro staff that I know of knew about this. And in fact, we're told now that there was a test, and it was called the a three-part track circuit verification test, which had been created following the Woodley Park collision and had been used, the Roslyn Tunnel near miss, I beg your pardon. It had been created after the Roslyn Tunnel near miss, and it had been used with some frequency for a period of time, and then the report was there was no problem, and its use was discontinued. I don't know by June 22nd or by June of 2009 how often that test was being used, but the fact of the matter is I have reviewed the materials that came to this board on the Roslyn Tunnel incident or near miss, which were presented to this board, and we were told at that time that the, quote, primary reason for this near miss was a 3,000-foot defective communication cable which had been fixed. And I believe even to this day, in discussions I've had with staff members this morning, that the people continue to believe that that was the problem, but that they had also developed this three-part test. But the fact of the matter is that this was a technology failure. I don't think we could hold up and you know, certainly I think this board needs to be accountable. And I want to be accountable as a member of this board. I'm very dedicated to the issues of this system. But the fact of the matter is that this technology failure, perhaps we can look back on this and say, well, that test should have been conducted twice a week like it is today. But seeing no problems, the staff proceeded on a different assumption. I just want to conclude by saying that, you know, because you do a lot of soul searching. You know, I was at that accident scene. You know, nine people dead, scores, injured, and you say to yourself, what could I have done differently as a member of this board? And I read your motion, Mr. Weiner, saying that we had ineffective oversight. And I've thought about that, and I've heard your comments saying we were tone deaf and that we've been monkeying around, and I've thought about that. And I take all of this very, very seriously. And I review this just for June 22nd, 2009. And I ask myself, Jim, what could you have done differently? What could you have done about this three-part test? What could you have done about this circuitry issue? What could you have done when you were told that a 3,000-foot cable which had been fixed was the problem with the Roslyn Tunnel? Jim, what could you have done? And I've asked myself that question many times on a very personal level. And I conclude that I don't know what I could have done. I know I worked to get money from the D.C. government successfully to buy these new rail cars. I know, like other members of this board, I have worked to find other resources to solve other problems that we have here. I know I am going to work with the NTSB in terms of the safety culture issues and the technology issues that our interim general manager have described. But as I look back on June 22nd, I'm not sure there's anything I could have done based on what I knew as a member of this board, and I was on this board in 2005. So I take to heart and I take most sincerely and seriously the recommendations you've made. I assure you that I want to work with you because, like every member of this board, we are here out of dedication. We're here because we care deeply about this system and its safety. There has never been any question about this in our minds. And I know we can be better. I know things can be improved. I'm very concerned about this alarm system. I have a number of questions relating to that, which we will carry into our board meetings. But let me conclude by thanking each of you, because this is an extraordinary meeting for the five of you to come and discuss with the 14 of us these most pressing and important issues. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Graham, for your comments. And let me repeat part of what Mr. Graham said there. This is a unique meeting. We really, really appreciate the fact that you have come and joined us, that you're willing to share with us. It may be that there was something that we could have done. I suspect there was. Now we know what those things are because of what you told us, and we're dedicated to going ahead and improving the safety of this organization. Maybe we didn't know all of the things we should have known. Maybe we didn't understand all of the things we should have understood. But we now know those things, and we now need to do something about them. Ms. Herzman, do you have... I understand Mr. Linton still wants to make a comment.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. And let me, too, thank the members of the NTSB who come before us today. I have not had the long history of working with this organization as my colleague, Mr. Downey, has, but I do, too, have a history of working with the NTSB. And having been the Federal Transit Administrator at one point during my tenure, I think this meeting has been very productive. Knowing my previous experience of serving on other boards of transit agencies and have seen similar type of accidents that have occurred over, at this point, it looks like 2 decades, I think this sort of meeting can be very productive, has been productive for us. And there's some real possibilities where if both invitations are provided by other boards in similar situations, I think the dialogue that occurred here today can be very productive, and it gives a different perspective of the relationships between the NTSB and the transit agencies. And I think for that in of itself, there's some value. So I would suggest that some consideration being given as to whether or not this can be something that can be done in future endeavors. And that's it.
Ms. Herzman, do you have some final comments before we adjourn our meeting?
I do. Most of all, I want to say thank you. Thank you for your consideration and your attention and your interest in our work. I did want to acknowledge that we know that there are a lot of people that work either in a paid capacity as frontline employees or in volunteer capacity on service to Metro, who do care about safety and who do want to make the system safer. And at the end of the day, I think the question that's the right question to ask is not what could you have done, but what are you going to do? And I think that what we heard today is a great step in the right direction of we know what your commitment is, and we're hearing it. And Mr. Charles, thank you so much for your responsiveness to our recommendation. We're very heartened to hear that someone sitting in the boardroom listening to our deliberations would go back and begin immediate action. Our recommendations are not worth anything unless people implement them. And what you all are doing moving forward on these things, we very much look forward to hearing about that and receiving documentation on what you're doing. We would very much like to close recommendations in a positive way. That is what we consider successful. Thank you, Mr. Sarles, Mr. Kubicek, Mr. Dougherty, Chairman Benjamin, and members of the Board of Directors. Your staff has been very good to work with throughout this investigation and has been excellent with our team as far as sharing in the learning and making changes and understanding what we were doing as we went along. So on behalf of all my colleagues, I do think that this was a unprecedented meeting, but a productive one. And so we look forward to offering our assistance either individually or collectively to you in the future. So don't hesitate to call on us.
Thank you again, Chairman Herzman, and for that offer as well. Before we close the meeting, Chairman Herzman and her board will be available to the press immediately after the adjournment. We ask that you talk with them first, and then if you wish to talk with Metro board members, that you do that after speaking with them. Thank you very much. This meeting is adjourned.